This is excellent. Okay. So I was just saying, this talk is the daughter of lockdown, nothing else to do at the time. So I started to do some work in quantum cosmology, which is something which, comes and goes. In the 80s, it was obviously something very physical, was the motivation of inflation in a way, where you needed it as a precursor of inflation. Then it went away. And I think it's time to bring it back, but maybe with a different way. And I think part of the problem is this problem, which is as old as Perimeter Institute, I think, which is cosmology and quantum gravity. People don't talk to each other. And there's good reasons for that. And quite often, the few times they talk with each other, they're at cross purposes. And there might be some kind of a background here in terms of what is considered rigor, what is considered connection with reality, etc. Part of the problem is the problem of time in quantum gravity. If you can't even find the time, forget about the thing we most cherish as cosmologists, which is contact with the real world and testability, falsifiability. So the thesis in this talk is that the problem of time is closely related to the problem of constants of nature. Basically, you can say that time is the conjugate of the constants of nature. You'll see this is not as abstruse as it might sound. I talked a lot to Chris Isham about this. And the problem is invariably, if you do anything which solves the problem of time in quantum gravity, you end up not with one time, but with hundreds of times. And then you have an embarrassment of riches in a way. But what I will tell you about is something called deconstantization. So it's a method of turning the constants of nature, things which are constant, on shell as the result of the equations of motion. And that's something which is not that strange, not that difficult. It's actually less constraining than things in which the constants of nature become scalar fields, which vary in space and time. That's not that kind of thing I'm working about, talking about. What I will argue is that there's nothing wrong with having many times, okay? So it could easily be that, you know, being this very pragmatic cosmologist thing, you just pick the time which is useful in a given epoch. There might be issues when you go from one epoch to another. I'll address that. That is a window of opportunity for testability, as far as I'm concerned. So that's basically what I will be talking about. But again, as I said, this is not as far-fetched as you might think. And in fact, unimodular gravity provides the blueprint. Maybe not the unimodular theory you've become used to. What is this?
What you're saying is being written there.
Oh, bloody hell. Model bacteria. I didn't say bacteria. Okay. I know my accent is a bit weird, but I did not say model bacteria. Baby. Okay. Is there a species of? Nah. Don't worry.
There is a white.
No, right.
Under a screen as well.
I can't see a thing. Even with my own screen, I can't see. Okay, close, Claudius. Enable, disable it.
Is it still there? Oh, yeah. There. I don't know.
It's your accent. It's my
accent. Whoever is in charge, could you turn off that transcription?
It's most irritating.
Oh, it is.
It's view transcript. Oh, I see. Yeah. Hide.
Hide? Loading meeting on.
I don't know. Just leave it. It's fine.
Okay. I couldn't figure this out.
And now look at we've done. Now I can't even see a thing. What's
doing something?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So as I was saying, and now I can turn this on. Okay. So the original idea of unimodular gravity was it goes back to Einstein, 1919. Okay. So the first attempt to have a unified theory of gravity in particle physics goes exactly to this dilemma. I mean, shall we consider general diffeomorphisms, or just diffeomorphisms which preserve the volume? And this is normally the association of unimodular, that this goes all the way up to Bill Unruh's famous paper, 1989. What I want to focus on is this alternative approach by Hanno and Teitelboim, which appears around the same time, in which I just noted that unimodular theory is nothing but just a generally covariant theory, so full diffeomorphism invariant with a Lagrange multiplier. Okay, so this is another way to look at things which does not break locality, Lorentz invariance, general diffeomorphism invariance. And the trick is this simple: you take your favorite action, here is going to be the Einstein carton, huh? Because I will need it for the connection, but it could be Cascaton, could be whatever, your favorite theory, right? You just pick it there, put it there, and you just add to your S0 this kind of term. So in this particular case, you have the cosmological constant, and then you multiply that by the divergence of a density. So it's very important not to put the square root of minus g there, because you want to preserve the Einstein equations. And these, the mu without the metric is actually covariant if that thing is a density. So it's not, it is a covariant derivative, or the normal derivative. That's what you get for a density. So this is great, because what you get immediately is that the constancy of lambda becomes an equation of motion. To demote, you deconstantize lambda in the sense that it becomes on equal footing as all the other constants of motion in your theory. It's a dynamical issue. And then because you don't, this is because the t, your t doesn't appear anywhere. Something which is not so widely known is that when you vary with respect to the lambda, which then becomes a constant, you get an equation for this Lagrange multiplier t, which makes it a really nice time variable, okay? So that's the point. You do gain not just the constancy of c, of lambda, sorry, in this case, as something which appears on shell only, you gain a time variable. So that's the implications. And this goes back to Stephen Hawking's first attempt to solve the cosmological constant problem. It really is very helpful that some constant is not just a parameter in your Lagrangian, but rather something which you can vary from equation of motion, from solution to solution. And something which is not so widely known is that you get this zero mode for the conjugate as a candidate, a perfect candidate for things like, in this case, well, a time, which is the four volume elapsed up to a given moment, but you'll see the quantum mechanics is going to be totally different. Okay, so one of the aspects of this talk is why not do this with anything else, everything else, okay? We did this with lambda, why not do this with everything? Which could be like the constant which dominates a given epoch. So it could be the gravitational constant, could be the total matter in the universe, for example. You have an m over a cubed, that m there in the mass matter epoch could be that. You have an m over a to the fourth, could be that m2, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the first question. And this is a mix and match, by the way. So you don't need to accept this in some parts of my talk. It could just use unimodular. Or in some other cases, you obviously need that because you need different clocks at different times. So that's one thing. Obviously, all.
Yeah. Say a little bit more. In what sense is the conjugate? What sense is it a time variable?
It just. Okay, one thing is. So, for example, it's a relational time variable. So, imagine I have a scalar field. So, forget completely different situation. The conjugate of these scalar fields using relational time are actually constants. The momentum is a constant, right? So this is the same thing, but starting from the other way around. So you give me a constant, you say, oh, here's my conjugate to my clock momentum, which is conserved, therefore I have a clock. So it's an internal definition of time. And there's no reason why it should work, right? So this is a very important point. The particular case of unimodular time, it's the four volume to the past, and then it varies. And I'll give you examples of this, depending. It's even the conformal time in some cases, right? And so it depends a lot, but it's basically one. And of course, whatever you give me, I'll give you a different time. This is the usual problem. You have different definitions of time. But yeah, what I'm saying is that no, don't get too freaked out with it. It's just what it is. Anything else? So what I was saying is this perhaps obvious thing, which later on is going to be important, that I can do canonical transformations. If one thing is a constant, a function of a constant is a constant, right? So you end up with a bunch of theories in which you choose different constants, different bases for these constants in this space. They're all equivalent to each other classically, and specifically they're all equivalent to general relativity. But of course, off shell and quantum mechanically, they're going to be quite different. Right, so this is one thing I wanted to say. Another one, okay, go on. Yeah.
This is the same as landscape, right? That is all the
classes. I don't like landscapes.
I know you don't like it, but it seems that you're an advocate.
I can say that, I don't listen to you. Okay. Well, it's landscape in the sense, but not in other senses. Namely, I mean, you can see it's, you know, it's not quite, I mean, landscape, you have to know how to go from one to the other, right? Because here you don't. just have solutions, right? And you'll see what happens later on with the quantum mechanics. So it's not the same. I mean, in a way, landscape is very classical. This is actually going to be very quantum. Classically, it's trivial, right? So it's the quantum mechanics that's going to be quite different.
But can you jump from one constant to another constant?
Classically, no. Quantum mechanically, you can make superpositions, which is different.
You can't jump as well.
No. Well, particularly the cases I'm going to give you, you don't. You have to modify the theory to do that. So what you can have is like a coherent state, which is Gaussian, picked around one constant, or and then with some fluctuation around it. But you cannot jump from one to the other. It's still a state.
They cannot evolve the superposition.
You can have superposition. Yeah. So you could have like a quantum multiverse if you want. If you do like different wave packets, which one of them classically, maybe you treat different ones, like different peaks at different places. So you could do that. I don't know why you like that stuff, right? Honestly.
I don't.
Okay. Matters of taste. Okay. This actually appeared not in that, maybe I never thought in that terms, but it's actually appeared in other situations. One is the thing I just mentioned, because it was the question you asked about relational time, right? So this doesn't need to be as abstruse as targeting the constants in a way. When you have relational clocks, you already do that. Except that you're not shocked by the momentum conjugate of scalar field being a constant, because it was never a fundamental constant, right?
Once again, with this thing,
sorry?
It seems like with this thing, that it seems like it doesn't mean that it is alpha, but alpha is also a constant, so I don't understand the relation.
Alpha is a generic constant.
Okay, and
so in this particular, okay, this is what I was going to say. This is one example of something which has appeared before called the sequester. I don't even know about the sequester, if you know about that stuff. So this has appeared before, and it's one example in which you do this not just with lambda, but with the gravitational constant.
Okay, but then what is T?
The T. Well, the T is a conjugate. So this is going to be the time variable, and now here you have a two-dimensional constant space. So we have two-dimensional times, right? So classically, this is all going to be on shell. They're all going to be a function of each other. Quantum mechanically, they're going to be different dimensions.
Okay, but then the T is the generalized time.
Yeah. So this thing here, is a generalization of the union modular trick. So I just multiply this by my constant of choice times this divergence there. And then again, because the T doesn't appear anywhere, when I vary with respect to T, I get the constancy of the constant on shell. When I vary with respect to my constants, here is whatever they are, right? It can be the lambda, can be anything else. I get a generalization for this time formula, basically. So before it was the thing which tell me on shell, my time was a four volume to the past. Here is whatever it must be. And yeah, I mean, there's no reason why this could work. It could be a bad time, right? But you know, in general, it's a good time. Okay? The examples I'm going to give you, they're actually good times. They're good relational times. You know these with scalar fields, they could be bad times as well. So anything else? This was meant to be an interactive meeting, not a talk. So I don't want to rob you of that experience, just interrupting anyone. OK, basically, this is one example. And in fact, here is funny, because you asked me what's the time. So in one case, it's just my volume time. The other case is the volume time weighted by the Ricci. So there is a Ricci time. And it turns out in the sequester, the observable, they stabilize the effective field theory cosmological constant, which is the Weinberg formulation of the cosmological constant, which we think is bullshit, if we put it this way. So we could just say effective field theory is inconsistent with gravity, right?
I should have pointed, this is being recorded. So.
Oh, yes, sorry. So that's one option. The other one is if you actually want to stabilize it, what they do is they make the observed value of the cosmological constant, what they call the fluxes on the boundary, so that stabilizes the local physics. And this ends up being, if you phrase it the way I'm doing it here, you basically said the observed cosmological constant is the ratio of the age of the universe, according to these two times, the Ricci time and the volume time. Don't like it. It's funny because we're not used to it, but it is one measure of time, right? So it certainly is better. You'll see when I get to Willard with the question, this is better because there's no time there, right? So at least having a time is a good thing. Okay, let me move on. So this is the basic point, the quantum mechanics. If you really want, this can be even more conservative. There is actually, you know, it's not easy to formulate fluids with Lagrangians, but there's one way to do it in which you can map this directly into the same framework which is used for relational clocks. And this is basically what Stefan Dillon has been doing about singularity problems and so on. So there's like three levels here. One is I'm basically generalizing unimodular, this trick, and I'm targeting the constants. You don't like that, there's the idea of scalar fields, or even just straightforward fluids, perfect fluids in this formulation by Brown. You can actually find a very nice way to basically decompose these into a constant momentum and clocks, right? Not sure you want to see that necessarily, but okay. So the quantum mechanics is what's different, obviously. And in a way, this should not surprise you. Quantum mechanics is the habit of sniffing of shell, right? So, and this was Stephen Hawking's original idea. When he tried to solve the cosmological constant problem, all he wanted was like a three form, which gave his lambda constant on shell, and he put this inside the path integral. And then there's a big controversy whether that works or not, but that was basically the idea. So it's one thing which is, so the quantum mechanics is going to be different. And as I pointed out already, there is a huge issue if you try to do quantum cosmology. You get rid of the time, you don't have a time. You end up with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which does not see the time because the Hamiltonian is zero. So you need to find some internal way of doing, finding the time. Right? So that's the thing, you can expect superpositions. So you're going to gain a time, you can expect superpositions. And more important, and you'll see this later, you can get a better grasp on normalizability of the states. So in a way, when you say my constants are fixed, my solutions are going to look like monochromatic waves. Monochromatic waves are always ill-defined, very bad beasts, which are not normalizable because they extend everywhere. I want these like to have superpositions, not so much to create a crazy many-world thing, but to create normalizable wave packets, which are physically understandable. So, so this is exactly what happens. I mean, let's do this in mini superspace. I'm not going to put the Hamiltonian there. Let's just look at the gravity. So I'm going to use the Einstein-Cartan. You'll see why in a minute. So the Einstein-Cartan, you're going to have the metric of the connection as independent variables, and my connection there, my B, is effectively the same as the Ashtecker connection, okay? Then you have a Hamiltonian, which starts like that. On shell, we are cosmologists, so what is this B? Everyone knows what the A is. So the A is the expansion factor, is my metric variable. My B on shell, if I do the Einstein equation, if I do the Hamilton equations, this thing is nothing but the inverse, the moving inverse Hubble volume. But now I'm going to be doing everything a la quantum gravity, so I'm going to give primacy to the connection. So make sure you start thinking in terms of B instead of in terms of A. So here it is. This is a very busy thing, busy anyway, where this is the full Hamiltonian. Let me do this with lambda first, because it connects with things people were doing here many years ago. A thing called the Kodama state or the Chern-Simon state, which is the result of solving the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in the connection representation. So this is what happens if I don't deconstantize the lambda. My lambda is a fixed number. My metric and connection, well, the complementary variables. I choose the connection representation in contrast with things we used to in cosmology. And what happens is that you end up with a Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which does not have the time because H is zero. So very easy to solve in this case. You just kind of massage these so that you end up with the first order equation in this format. You just pick the factor in front of the A square. This is it. Trivial to solve, you just exponentiate. And you end up with the Chern-Simon state. So this is a very important thing in quantum gravity. Before loops, this was like the solution which came out of the Ashtecker variable. You end up with this state called the Chern-Simon state. Where is the time? What's the physics? Where is the cosmology? No one knew. So that's exactly the kind of thing which could be different from this perspective, right? If you deconstantize, remember, now my alpha, which in this case is three, so very important. It's actually makes your life easy. It's not essential, but makes your life easy. If you solve this, you find the wave number. So wave number is in the spatial guy. In this case, it's not lambda, it's 3/lambda. That's what appears, right, in these guys here. This is my phi there, which is 3/lambda. And now I told you, using lambda or a function of lambda didn't make any difference. Classically, quantum mechanics really makes your life much easier. Okay. So basically, I deconstantize the thing which appears as my phase, as my wave number. And this is what you get. Okay. So, first thing, three good things immediately. Where before we had this issue that there was a timeless Wheeler-DeWitt equation, now we have a Schrodinger equation. Okay. So, nothing different from things like relational time. You choose some internal degree of freedom to act as a clock, and therefore, what looks like a timeless Hamiltonian constraint becomes actually a Schrodinger equation. Second thing, which is where this point about picking your time correctly, you do end up with these solutions if you put a monochromatic, if you have a monochromatic ansatz, okay? But this thing now has a time, right? So beforehand, it was just a spatial thing. No one knew the physics of that. Well, now you do because there's a time there. And more important, that's your question, I can superpose, obviously, because if the phi, the lambda is only a constant on shell, quantum mechanically, I can choose any state which superposes that. No one knew what the inner product was here. These things did not look very normalizable. That was part of the problem. It's completely obvious what to do here, okay? I even feel a bit ashamed of what I'm going to do in the next thing. It's just so trivial, right? I just have to choose these amplitudes to be sufficiently peaked or sufficiently well behaved so that I have a normalizable state, which then can be physical. So, yeah.
Each constant alpha.
Say it again.
Is there a equation for each constant alpha?
Or? Yeah. So this is the issue about multi-time. Are you going to embrace it or not? I mean, as I said at the beginning,
I think the whole idea sounds very cool. You have this one wave function and it has to satisfy these different.
So the thing I'm going to be doing next is actually making this multidimensional, right? Different times, different constants. And then the ideas are following. I mean, so quantum mechanics, classically, there's no doubt that the equation of motion for the different times, well, they all have to be function of each other, right? Because there's nothing else they can be. Quantum mechanically, it's more like that these things are going to follow classical trajectories in these different times. And because they picked, these introduces indirectly a function between the different times being used, right? Because when this peak is here, that peak must be there, therefore. So you do recover the classical limit. I mean, we don't see many times, right? But quantum mechanically, it's really different, right? And I will be writing it explicitly because it is important. I mean, there are things like what, okay, so last week, Nayash and I solved the cosmological constant problem, solved forever, okay? And that's actually starting from the point of view, there's only one time, which is a lambda time, right? So, and then there's some constraints, it's really cool. I'm going to be doing other things here. I have an open mind about this. I'm going to be doing other things which don't work with just one time. So you need, like, for example, if there's effects here and now, you better make sure that we're changing clocks when you go from matter domination to lambda domination. Otherwise, it's just disastrous. They are okay. So classically, they're going to be just one, right? But quantum mechanically, they are different energies, different frequencies. So you can think of these as frequencies and times, right? So my frequencies are going to be the constants. If I choose one constant, I have one frequency. If I choose different constants, I have more than one. I must have more times. Yes, but I mean that's the question is how far do you want to play this game? So I'm being pragmatic. Sometimes you may need more than one time, right? It could go on forever, right? But the question is, if you want to have a description of the universe evolving, sometimes you need more than one. But I mean that's a question. I mean, you really want to have an infinite number of times? So it's a choice. So this is completely flexible how you set up the formulas. Maybe I'll give you an example in a bit, so you're going to see. It's not as crazy as. Classically, this is going to go. You end up with the Einstein equations. Classically, this is just relativity. Classical. Because one of the equations of motion is telling you that these things are constant. And then, yeah, we do end up with these time things, but who cares? You don't need to use them, classically. It's quantum mechanically that this is intrinsically different. You see, the Hilbert space acquires this guy and its conjugate, if you, depending on the representation, right? So you are enlarging the Hilbert space, quantum mechanically. Classically, you're not doing anything. So I'm basically, classically, this is exactly the same as the usual, as business as usual. When you do the equations of motion, the Einstein equations, blah, blah, blah.
If you're enlarging the Hilbert space, in a sense, you're producing fields.
Sorry, say it again. Sorry.
You are introducing fields,
Yeah, so this is very different from like space-time varying fields, right? Because these things on shell become constant, right? So it's a completely different story.
But I mean, because now you are on the topological space, so you're
going. No, if you go beyond municipal space, I mean they're actually constant in space and time. Okay. Of course, in municipal space is just the time what you get there. Yeah. Well, let me continue because I think there might be a couple of examples here which might clarify something there. Okay, the thing I was saying is actually the inner product. Okay, so a big issue with the Kodama state and Simon state, what does it mean physically, blah, blah, blah. This is the thing I was even ashamed of putting. It's completely obvious, right? You want an inner product, go one level up and build it out of these amplitudes in the superpositions. This thing is time independent by construction. So this is unitary. And as long as the waves have that form, and they don't always have that form, you can actually then use the Fourier theorem and find a measure in B space. So this doesn't happen all the time, right? It only happens when I am, for example, using the lambda clock and I am in the lambda epoch. And then the waves are really simple. So there's this plane waves in X, therefore I can use the Fourier theorem and end up with a measure. Now this may look a bit trivial, and in a way it is, but one of the big issues is, what does it mean physically? Well, Lee was almost there. I think Lee is listening to us. He'll be proud of this, or maybe not. So Lee wrote a paper in 2009 about unimodular gravity, and he recognized this. So he recognized that one of the things you gain from this Kodama state, which you don't understand very well, if you go one level up and you deconstantize my jargon, he didn't use this jargon, if you deconstantize the lambda a la unimodular a la Henu, so not the version, then you do get these superpositions and you get this time variable. A very important thing, right? So really the quantum mechanics changes dramatically. And don't laugh, because this is not obvious. Why is it that people did not know the meaning of the Kodama state? It was not normalizable, blah, blah, blah. Where is the time? Where's the classical limit? It's nowhere. So you have, obviously, in that Hilbert space, you can have anything you want. So the states could be very complicated, but you could just imagine, you could also have the Nyash crazy peaks and so on, but you could just have like a Gaussian packet. Plug that inside, you end up with the usual thing. So just with a packet with the bits inside between your conjugate variables and then an exponential, which is like a Gaussian. We have an inner product, so you know what the probability is. You basically end up with a state which saturates the Heisenberg relation between your constant and your time, and the peak follows this. I think this might have been your question about the metric, I'm not sure. This is one way to write a solution, okay? If you want to write, so we're using B, not A. If you want to write B as a function of T, as a parametric expression, it turns out this is an exercise for the student, very nice one. If you're teaching cosmology, just do something like this. Very nice exercise in using Friedman equations, okay? So this follows the Friedman equations. And in fact, the peak of these coherent states follows the classical equations of motion. Any questions about this? This is non-trivial. Should be trivial, but it's non-trivial. A lot of quantum gravity ends up with a mess. Why plane waves? From this perspective, well, you're doing this plane wave, so it's not surprising that you get complete nonsense in terms of physics.
So this is just a lambda. GR, or is this more general?
This is exactly. Right? The next thing I'm going to do is generalizing this. This is just lambda because it's the case that was most, that was best known, okay, before. So I don't want to stop you asking questions. I'm just going to summarize the things I needed to say. Okay, this is your question. This extends to things which are much more complicated. So you can expense water equations of state. I don't think this was appreciated, but the Chern-Simon state and the Chern Simons functional can be written for anything. Okay, so literally any other equation of state you can play, particularly the way I phrased it here, you can always write things in a way that you end up with an X, which depends on lambda, blah, 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 and you do the same thing. And then the rest of the story is the same. So you can still do like plane waves, blah, blah, blah. Same story. So this generalizes. You might say this is monofluid. You get exactly the same thing. So pure lambda works, pure matter works, pure radiation works. What's not trivial is the transitions, okay? And that works as well. It's less trivial. I mean, this is probably what you're asking, what happens if I have many times. Not sure you can see, it's bold phase, right? So you actually have a different dimensional space in times, but basically the whole thing goes through. Except that here it becomes obvious that you have a dispersive medium, right? So when you go from matter domination to lambda domination, we have like a dispersive medium. And what you can do, what you can do is play the same games there with the group speed. What seems to be going on? Okay. You're gonna miss the best bit. So it's more complicated in this case because you basically have a dispersive medium. So we have something like a Gaussian approximation around the peaks. And then if the peak is there, then this thing does follow the equations of motion. So it's non-trivial, but you know, you can actually get this to work for fluids other than lambda and also for multi-fluids in the transition phases with different times. You don't like the times? I don't know. I think it's just a matter of, it can be very useful for phenomenology, right? If you don't like the times, just use the lambda time. Yeah. You can fix most states, exactly. I mean, that's one thing. So one of the things I'm going to do would not work if I just had one time. So I you know, mea culpa. Okay, so
can I ask, what is X?
So the X is the thing which, okay, very good point. Maybe a good issue is what comes out of the equations. That's one way, which is a very terrible way to actually write this. So these things end up being plane waves. Okay, let me give you the example of lambda, okay? Oh, there it's a. So these things end up being plane waves, not in B, not in the connection, but in these functionals of B. And this just comes out case by case from the equations of, from the Schrodinger equation, okay? So this comes out of solving the equation. This is a suggestion that this is much easier if I deconstantize not lambda, but the function, the wave number, which appears there. So not just X is not just a, this is a plane wave in X, not in B, but the frequency is not lambda, but 3/λ.
Okay.
And then you should make things easier, what you should do is make the frequency the same. Okay, these things are intrinsically dispersive media in B. So these things, if you know anything about doubly special relativity, which is where the inspiration for these in general came from, these things are linearizing variables. So every time I have a dispersive medium, there's always a variable in terms of which, I mean, if you have deformed dispersion relations, you can define an E and a P, which are linear, which are actually not deformed, right? It's the same thing.
But again, what is X a particular function? Can I pick anything or is it?
No. This comes out of case by case. I actually work this. Okay.
Is this a big cube thing? Or?
It's the big cube. It's a Chern Simons functional. So this guy there is a Chern Simons functional for, in fact, you're going to see the example for lambda in a minute. In general, it's whatever it is, right? It's whatever comes out. So it's this function here. Yeah. So you basically, case by case, you work it out. It's not a free function. Okay, so let me move on to the bit of the talk which I think is most important. Great, we got the, I mean, this is non-trivial, right? I know a lot of people who have done careers and become professors and they never connected with the real world. Quantum gravity, they should be ashamed of themselves. And well, at least you get the classical limit, but of course, big deal, right? I mean, what you don't want to get the classical limit, you want to get corrections to the classical limit. So this is the two things I'm going to give you here in the last, how long have I got, 20 minutes or so. So I don't want to go into details much, but I want to give you a flavor of stuff I've been doing with Stefan Gillen and try to, well, A, make this testable. So could there be corrections here and now? I need the two times for that, I'm afraid, okay? And the other one is something which for me is not a problem, okay? I'm being recorded. I don't care about the singularity problem. I couldn't care less about the singularity problem. It just happens we can solve it, I think. I do care about cosmological constant problem, except we cannot solve it. I was joking, okay? So I think you guys have worked on this a lot, right? So trying to get rid of singularity in different ways. Well, Stefan certainly did, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you tried to do this in many different ways as well, like using complexification of the metric. Right? And there's all these different ways of doing it. I mean, I don't know if I don't think I will lose my sleep on the singularity problem, but I can see it's a bit annoying.
Well, my impression is, I think if I'm right correctly, I didn't say you don't want to solve it, you want to embrace it. That's more correct. Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to embrace it, I'm going to solve it. it was a surprise to me. It was a surprise. But in a way, I mean, you could never solve it in quantum graph. The question here is, can I just solve it with basic quantum mechanics and basic relativity with this very simple extension? Okay, let me show you this, but actually, it might give you a concrete example of various things you've asked. It's particularly simple here. My Hamiltonian is really simple. So this M here could be the total matter of the universe. Could be the G, the gravitational constant, which appears there, right? It's in there. Could be whatever. And what I'm going to be doing is solve the Wheeler-Lewitt equation and deconstantize this M and see what I get. So it's kind of, you know, here the equation of state is a third. So you work out everything. There's nothing free here. These x's are not free functions. You work it out. The same story. You basically turn this into a Schrodinger equation. Therefore, three things you gain. You gain the time factor. You're going to superpose. You get to superpose these m's. In this case, the alpha is just the n. It should be written somewhere. It's here. And this is my x. There you are. And yeah, she asked the question. Pay attention. Okay. So when k is zero, this is minus one over b in that case. And it's just completely like worked out. Plus the inner product, everything else, you basically gain this stuff. And now the question is, what happens when you move away from the semi-classical region? So let's imagine I do pick something which has the right semi-classical limit. So it's a Gaussian state, saturates the Heisenberg principle. I told you the measure is dx by dB, it's not b. I have to work this out. I plug this inside here, and I get on with it. So in this particular case, what is my time? Well, classically, T dot, you work it out, is going to be minus conformal time. I mean, these things always have a physical interpretation when you go on shell, right? They're very simple, okay? So the other one was volume time. For volume time, this is just conformal time. In fact, it's here, right? It's minus the conformal time. And of course, there is an uncertainty in those states, but as long as my t is sufficiently big, then this uncertainty is negligible. And even work out, you know, just what is actually the spread in B. So this thing is a coherent state in X, not in B. But you work it out and it's small, so you end up with this state. Oh, very nice. So
this one is conformal time. It's for this constant bigger conformal time.
So this is the M, right? So the M which appears there, which contains G. Now, this is what I was saying. You were playing with your phone. This is what happens. When you play with your phone, then you miss these important points. Okay, so this is a general case. So if you have, if I go back, so can you?
Is it matter density?
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you go here, in general, there's this constant of motion here. So this is where that Brown article, you actually pay attention. That's actually the constant which appears in the Brown formalism, which goes beyond mini-space for perfect fluids, is actually related to this. There's always a constant there. So the constant could be seen as like rho a cubed for matter or rho a fourth for a.
Is it conformal time for all w's?
No. This is just for lambda, for w equals a third for a question for radiation. So remember, it was four volume time for lambda, yeah. Right? It's actually proper time for matter. You can work it out case by case. Yeah.
It makes sense, the proper time.
Makes sense, but I agree. Now, these things, after a while, they look a bit abstruse, and I'm very sympathetic to your criticism. But once you get used to these different times, they, you know, it's just basically different choices, except you're not saying the coordinates, you're saying the physical times on the basis of some internal degrees of freedom which you're picking. And it could be fluids, right? I mean, as I said, this could be just a perfect fluid thing, blah, blah, blah. Where was I? Okay, I was getting to a very important point. Oops. I'm already showing you. So this is what happens if I do a limit in which the t is much bigger than the sigma t. By the way, you asked me this question the other day already. Okay, when I do these choices, so these m zeros I'm kind of using, the m zero could be anything, obviously, and the sigma could be anything. So So I'm picking a state in which there is a spread. I don't want this to be a delta function. I want this to be a type of spread. The spread could be anything. But the point is it's fixed. And the point is there's going to be a t after which modulus of t is bigger than sigma t. And therefore, I can do all these approximations and end up exactly with something which I was actually surprised. This is what happens. So you basically remember this is b, not a. So b universe goes that direction, right? And what happens is that as the time becomes bigger and bigger, this thing gets sharper and sharper. So this thing is non-dispersive in terms of x. If it's dispersive in terms of b, it's anti-dispersive. It just sharpens the peaks more and more as the time goes on. So the solution is exactly the opposite. Now, suppose I go backwards in time. And this is where the fun starts. What actually happens if I suddenly jump into a t, which is of the order of the sigma t, which I chose. Could be the Planck time, could be whatever I want. Okay. And then what happens is basically this thing saturates. At some point, the peak, instead of going to infinity, saturates at one maximum b, which I can work out in terms of this sigma t. And then what happens is that this is actually the other way around. So this is at some point. So the thing was very happily moving to infinity, got stuck here. And then this is the dispersive effect. The dispersive effect is to lower this peak. And then another peak starts opening on the other side. So symmetric, but negative. So in other words, when I get t equals zero, I actually have equal superpositions between an expanding universe and a contracting universe with the same saturated curvature. So I never have a singularity. I did not embrace singularity, I solved it. I don't know if you like it or not. And then you go the other way around. This is completely symmetric. You go the other way around. And of course, this guy starts increasing, this is decreasing. And effectively, what I have here is just a transition, a completely regular transition, quantum mechanical transition between a contracting universe and an expanding universe without actually going off to infinity. So this is what you gain if you actually start thinking, yeah, this is like a summary of the thing. So actually, I have all the numbers here. You can actually work out in terms of sigma t what the saturated b is. This is the symmetric distribution I mentioned. You can even write it down. And there you are. You basically end up with this transition. So different interpretations. So Stefan and I have been discussing where does this come from. So my mind, this boils down to the fact that time is intrinsically quantum when t is of order of sigma t. So you're basically smearing. Your wave function is smearing everything. According to Stefan, I think I start to see his point. This is unitarity. I mean, the wave function had to go somewhere, right? This is a unitary theory. My inner product doesn't depend on time because it's built like from the constant space downwards. So if I see these things evolving in time, probability cannot disappear. Where is it going to go? I mean, where could it go, right? So I don't know. I mean, there's different ways to look at it. But the fact that it never goes to infinity, the infinite curvature is in part due to the measure. The fact you have this measure basically that falls off like 1/t and therefore regularizes everything. Okay, that's one thing. I still have 10 minutes. The other one, which is this guy's a pain. I mean, every time I come up with a good idea, he said, how do you test it?
Oh, actually, before you.
The pain is a pain.
What does it end up peaking at? What sets the value that.
So maybe I went to depend. This is the point about whether this, okay, this guy's a pain. Where do you get that sigma t from? Okay. So the sigma t is what I put in, right? Or the sigma n, right? So I have these two complementary constants which saturate the Heisenberg principle. If I take a Gaussian state, they saturate. That's free. It could be the Planck, could be whatever, right? The saturated b is this 1/√ of.
State, not by the trend.
Yeah.
Constant, but,
yeah.
I guess combination of the
trend. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it could be, I mean, that's exactly that. I mean, this is free, right? So Stefan actually told me this. I mean, he told me that in general, even going back to Bryce DeWitt and all these guys, they thought the Planck time is going to come out of any kind of solution. It doesn't. There's always a free thing there, but it could be anything. He was not very shocked by this. I was a bit shocked because I'm sympathetic to this view. This thing should be testable, blah, blah, blah. So. Anything else? I'm going to be moving to a very different thing.
I have a question.
Okay.
On Zoom.
Okay.
Yeah. When you showed the probability distribution curves, So you're saying that it's the time that is increasing and decreasing?
Yeah, these functions are these wave functions are a function of time. This is a Schrodinger equation.
So how do you explain when you say that the classical universe would be contracting? So you're still talking in terms of time, or are you also talking in terms of like the actual universe contracting somehow?
So I think you have to be careful with that time, because that time is a parameter in your Schrodinger equation, right? But there's no reason why you have a classical interpretation for that. It's a parameter, and you go through that. When the sigma t is much smaller than t, you can use the time equation, the classical equation, to say this is conformal time. When I reach a t, which is of the order of sigma t, yeah, you cannot make that interpretation. There is still a parameter, it evolves, it's your state. I mean, if you have a Gaussian state, for example, with a spread in x, the x is still defined, right, when the thing moves. It's just classically, you would not be measuring that x. So I think it's in that sense that you could say, it's this lack of definition in this state for time when you're going through the singularity that probably smears everything. That would be my interpretation. Does this answer? Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Anything else? This is a good point to actually ask questions. I don't need to go through the rest. So the rest is this thing, can I actually test this now? Okay, can we? So it just so happens, we're very lucky in a way, and very unlucky in other ways. We live in interesting times. It's a very bad joke, given what's been happening recently. Sorry about that. But what I mean is that cosmologically, we live at a time in which we have different equations of state with energies comparable. So if there are two clocks, which is why I need the two clocks here, right? We're about to change time zone. So if there is any kind of effect here, which is a prediction, this is a very good time to test it. Second thing, remember, I did everything in terms of my B. My B is the connection. It's the thing which appears in the Chern-Simon state. But for cosmologists like us, down to Earth cosmologists, it's the inverse Hubble volume. And this thing was decreasing, and now it's increasing, right? So we had a bounce. I know we're thinking about bounces in terms of metric, but in terms of the connection, last billion years or so, a few billion years, we've had a bouncing connection space, okay? So a very strange way to put things, but then not only have we changed time zone and clock and so on, we went from a matter clock, but we actually also had the bounce. Very difficult to solve the problem, okay? So this is what I did with Stefan. Let's solve a toy problem and see if there's anything here which is doable. But we already talked about this. There's something really funny about radiation and lambda. I mean, they're really a nice combination of things. I'm trying to do this with a student with matter and lambda. It's a mess. We get there. We'll get there. So you can go through all these things. These x's are not free functions. You go through this. One thing is that you cannot get rid. You get the right limits. But what happens is that my x there will depend on my lambda and my m. OK, so it's the only big difference. Not only is my Chern-Simon state to be modified when I go from one equation of state to the other, but in the transition, that function itself depends on the constants I've put in. Okay, so it's a very different story. It's not easy. You see, there you are. So this is the thing which maybe you can't see. It's the thing which is quite shocking because there's a bold face here. There's different times, different frequencies. So you just hope that in the semi-classical limit, this thing will give you just one time. The question is the corrections. We find corrections to this or not. So there's two times here, two constants, and I want to go through the solutions. Why is there a chance of creating testability here? Because we have a reflection. I mean, there's nothing like a reflection to highlight quantum behavior, right? There's even a thing called quantum reflections in which you paradoxically end up measuring quantum effects because the wave nature of the things a bit counterintuitively comes to the fore, right? So this is exactly what happens here, right? And we have not solved the real thing, but you can see it here. Basically, you have an incident wave, a reflected wave, you have an evanescent wave, just like normally in any reflection problem. So even if you dress these guys with wave packets, well, you know what happens. If you were to do the psi square of this, this thing would be just a constant. But what actually happens is that the incident wave and the reflected wave interfere. It's called ringing, and this is what happens when you have a reflection, okay? Even if you dress these things with packets, you don't see the envelope you actually see the ringing inside. So that's what I'm showing you here. You build the wave packets. So not much detail here, but it's the same story. But now, of course, this thing propagates into integrals for a spatial psi corresponding to the incident one, the reflected one, and the evanescent wave. And yeah, not sure you can see this or not. There you are. So you don't just see, I mean, you see this thing, if there was not this interference between the two, you would just see like the exponential, the envelope. Because you have this interference, you end up with these objects here. Is this observable or not? I have no idea. That's an interesting point. More interestingly, perhaps, is basically be a bit less, okay, this will be completely quantum, right? And now you can have questions like, how would an observer inside the quantum world see this world? How would the classical observer see a quantum universe? Okay, that's, I don't want to go there. Okay, I'm sure we could have very long discussions about this. One thing you can do is just basically do a semi-classical approximation. Like in everything, you know, basically the inner product as well. And then what you get is, in fact, you kill, if you do something like that, you actually kill the interference, the ringing. You see semi-classical. So all you have is these psi squares with these dx's. So there's none of these interpretations. I am semi-classical, but I'm still incorporating the fact that I have a reflection. And this is what you find. So in this case, you're not going to see the ringing. But because of that measure factor, you see there is a divergence here near where you have a bounce, a small b0. And then at some point, basically, the peak of the main thing starts getting a bias towards this b0. So it's a bit as if this b0 where I reflect is a bit sticky, right? So he wants to get the wave function close to it.
Are you talking about now or at the bounce?
The bounce, this is the bounce. Well, then a bit, two parts of the talk. This is the bounce in the last billion years, whatever, 7 billion years or 10 billion years. This is when we went from the...
Bouncing
B.
Because of the lambda domination. I see.
So this is really now. This is not in the early universe. It's not the end of the world. Okay. This is two talks, don't confuse the two. One, there was a quantum transition from a contracting universe. It's not even a bounce, it's just a transition, right? If you want to see it this way. Then this is the interesting times. Interesting times is now. The universe has gone from a B which was decreasing to a B which is increasing. Because we were decelerating, now we're accelerating. And the correction is this one. You basically want your wave function wants to get stuck there. So there is a small period, and we know how small it is, in which the evolution, well, this could be very small. Okay, let me just show you the effect. So there is this divergence. I'm not sure if this is observable. It all depends on parameters, depends on details as well, like matter or radiation. Remember, T dot was X dot. Okay, classical thing, you have a correction, and you can work out the correction. This. So I'll stop here and I'm going to go over time. I hope I give you a flavor of these things. Watch this space. The realistic case of matter and lambda transition is still being worked out. And of course, now I shouldn't have solved the cosmological constant problem. That is not exactly with these, but I think, yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So what does it take to make the modification in the classical equations of motion for B large enough to explain the element?
Yeah, that is a very good question. Clearly there is. So this is why I need two clocks, otherwise it'd be a disaster, right? If I make the parameters big enough, I need to change clock going to matter. The question is, so this was radiation, right? With matter is a different story. And the question is fitting everything in. I mean, I don't want to screw up Big Bang nuclear synthesis or whatever, right? I want to have a clock, you know, which reproduces the successes. So could there be a correction now? And of course, the Hubble tension, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I want to go there, but that's basically the idea. Could there be a correction? I was surprised to find it, okay, even at this level, right? So I was surprised to find a correction. But in a way, this is a question about reflections. Ringing might be a bit ambitious, but even at the level of semi-classical limit, they are corrections. Every time you have a, you know, this is a reflection in B.
If you did want to push something to explain a few percent effect, how wide the wave function is.
It's exactly that kind of game. We are hoping to, well, So the matter, so the realistic thing is matter, not radiation, and the story is completely different. And you just have to adapt it there. Constraints are different as well, because you could have three different blocks, one for radiation, one for matter, one for lambda. I don't know, is this too baroque? What do you think? At least it's compact with experiment, but I don't know. I can see why people prefer solving the singularity problem. <Not that.
laughs> So roughly speaking, if the width is of order a few percent, you
might
have a few percent correction.
Yes, precisely, precisely. I mean, of course, the question is, this could actually be not just, you could lose the peak, right? You saw that. There's a small period around the actual turnaround, right? The turnaround in B, in which you lose the main peak and just get stuck in this here. Would this be observable? Well, I mean, we don't know exactly when this happened, right? That's one of the issues. Right? There's a certain margin of possibility, so.
Other questions for Jean?
So, I have questions about the so essentially, what we are trying to do is a multi-dimensional version.
Yeah.
And we produce new times, one for each. So first, a question would be, why that is a time of the space? So why do I reduce in the time?
But you do. I mean, but that you solve, right? Once you have that, you solve it. And then this is the axis you asked me about. I'm not introducing them. I'm computing them. So they're all a function of B, but the different functions of B, and the waves are, they remain coherent in this functional, which is the Chern-Simons functional for lambda, right? But which in general is whatever, I have to compute it, and it's different from, depending on the equation of state. So you saw what happened. We saw what happened with the radiation. Radiation is very interesting because it just basically spreads this way, and then basically falls off. It cuts off the peaks are saturated and then falls off.
Okay, so
no, because classically that's what happens. I mean, so in a way that you're right. I mean, the mini superspace doesn't know about this. Could be anything, right? You end up with this. You're right.
But T was a vector, like a four vector. So you could say T0 is time and then Ti is a space.
Right? But you're introducing different ones. So it's a bit weird, you're right. I mean, so the reason is I'm not doing something completely bonkers, like 10 dimensional times or something. What I'm doing is something which at some point connects with a semi-classical regime. And all these different t's become a function of each other, in the sense that my wave function moves in some x space and then different times, and you have this product of two things which have a peak, and therefore introduces implicitly a t as a function of t prime, right? That you are. On shell, they're not independent, and if I have a sufficiently peaked state, they become function of each other as well along the peaks. So it's in that sense. But you're right, I mean, yeah. Yeah. So you could think, for example, let's think about relational time. Imagine I have 25,000 scalar fields, right? And I'm using them all as like times. I mean, you can, but of course, they all become a function of each other classically. Right? You don't relate it to, sir? Yeah. This is the thing, the quantum mechanics. One thing which I was interested about is the universe classical if the various factors are all classical, or is it enough, or is it okay if one of them is not classical? So imagine that I have a state which is semi-classical in one of the times and constants, but not in the other. Does this mean the universe is quantum, or just means the clock is crap? Because it could be that, right? So you could just say that, right? My clock is not a good clock, right? So I don't know the answer to this question. It's basically that, man. I mean, these states are all the simplest ones. You could come up with completely crazy states, right? And then say, this is observable. Typically, it's just kind of contradict observations immediately. I mean, universe is not brutally quantum, or is it? I don't know. Some people have actually said, what if we live in a quantum universe and they've not noticed? I don't know. could be hidden from us somewhere, right? I don't know. Well, this was well, actually, causal sets were here before anyone. I mean, I think Raphael was doing stuff with any model of gravity a long time ago. The question is, could this be coupled to string theory? I mean, anything could be coupled to string theory, I guess. I don't know. I haven't thought about it. I haven't thought in those terms, but I mean, so I wouldn't do this with the electron mass, for example, or anything. I mean, so that is the question. Well, feel free to write the paper. It could be interesting. I mean, I have no idea. It could be actually an interesting question. I mean, I came at this from the other point of view, from the cosmology point of view. In which case, you don't invent a clock because for no reason. You invent a clock because you need one, right? So it's a different story, right? So, but it could be.
I said this is a landscape, so it's
always shut up.
Probably is more constrained than the landscape, because the landscape is completely unconstrained, so you have infinity many parameters. But he's saying that
there are solutions
many times, but they are not all independent, and therefore you are achieving the same thing in this time.
But you have the Hilbert space. So the Hilbert space could be anything, right? So you could imagine any state there. So it's some would be classical, in which case the different times would be a function of each other. Some might not be classical at all. I mean, I don't know. So it's in a way, you probably want something like that, you know, if you want a landscape. You want something like, for example, uniformly distributed in the constants or something.
I don't know. This is my gut feeling, but I think there are enough moving parts in both of them. I mean, string theorists don't think landscape is unconstrained. They think if they have, eventually someone is going to understand everything there. But right now, we're not there.
Yeah, we're going to understand this. We are going to understand.
This one we are going to understand.
So I tell you what we've been doing. So it's a bit crazy, but we just use the lambda clock, right? And then the question is, suppose I force the lambda clock all the way back. Well, we did various things. At some point, actually, funnily enough, what happens is that the thing becomes totally, I mean, it becomes quantum before the Planck time. So it could be
right.
If lambda is zero, if you say lambda is zero, then the sigma lambda is zero. Therefore, the sigma t is infinite. Therefore, the universe will never be classic. It must have a lower bound.
And then actually create
classical universe. And the lambda we have creates classical universe around 10 to the 13 GeV. If you follow the
Should we say bye? Okay.